This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. It's currently 9:36 right now on BFM 89.9. I'm David Chu. I've got Melissa Idris and also Sharad Kutan with me. Today is, as what we have every Monday, Pressing Matters comes on. And our guest with us this morning is the Chief Executive Officer and also Editor of the Malaysian Insider, Jabba Sarik. Jabba, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning, yes. And Pressing Matters, of course, we invite members of the press to join us over here and we discuss about ongoing topics that have been, well, not only reported in their papers, but also to flesh things out a little bit more and also to give us another insight into the stories that you're covering as well. Melissa, what are the stories we are looking at?
Well, of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the kerfuffle at Lau Yat Plaza that happened over the weekend. Yes. Now, it started on Saturday, the drama did, and it started with a young man who was at Lau Yat to buy a phone, and what allegedly happened was when the salesman turned around, turned his back to the customer to get something from the back, I think it was a free gift, this young man allegedly ran off with the phone. So later in the day, I think some of his friends had come back to the plaza and allegedly attacked the store where that happened. And that escalated very quickly into what many are saying, growing racial tensions between the Chinese and Malay. Apparently, the Malay group, Malay rights group, Pakida, was on the scene where 200 people had gathered.
Jabba, you know, why did you choose to kind of run with the story? It seems at one point, at some level, that this is exactly what some groups in this country want. They want these kinds of stories foregrounded to create the impression of growing tensions, that these growing tensions are manufactured, not real and on the ground. Why did you choose to run that story? It was the last story you had yesterday.
Well, a friend told me about what happened, and I told my colleagues we have to look into this because there's always a threat of violence in our country. And something small, you know, an alleged theft. Some people were saying that he was sold a fake phone, and then it escalated into a case of a certain community always cheats, and this is the time now we boycott them, and you know, we are so and so, and we are entitled to better things, and it's actually a symptom of our country. You know, something happens, and something is spun out into something else, and then people make this kerfuffle, as it was. It was more than a kerfuffle. Five people were injured, three journalists. It's a big thing in Malaysia for the simple fact that this happens all the time in Malaysia at a top level and at the bottom level. Something always spins out and becomes something else.
Now, one of the things is the police response. The IGP, I believe, put out statements suggesting that this was a minor issue. The police were going to act on it. They were going to deal with the individuals involved. This was not a community against community issue. So I think in some sense, the message coming out of the police was spot on in terms of kind of like putting a damper on the rising tensions, if any existed.
I think the police were spot on from day one on Saturday. They said this is nothing but a theft, a case of theft. Nothing racial about it. But, you know, we are at a stage where people don't trust the police anymore on anything they say. And although the police are right, I think 85% of the time, people just don't trust them. The police had to lock down Bukit Bintang. Mm. Amazing. You know, I've never heard of us locking down any place in a long while.
Mm. Well, the other thing is, well, people may not believe the police, but they seem to believe everything they read on social media, because there's a photo going around that showed a young man being assaulted on the floor, which turned out to be inaccurate because it was actually a photo from another incident in Shah Alam about a year ago.
You get a lot of that. I mean, there was pictures of kids dying in Syria and was taken from another place. It's the power of social media, right? We believe our friends. We won't believe anyone else. So people take advantage of that. They inject old pictures. It circulates around. I mean, all of us go through this. And now it's just a matter of thinking before we send that picture onwards.
Speaking of friends, Papa Gomo, Parupukari, I think, or something like that. Now, these are names that were kind of associated with the kind of cyber warfare that was going on a couple of years ago. Mm. They've, as far as I remember, and I can tell, they've actually kind of submerged, and now they've reappeared in this incident. What do you kind of make of that?
Well, you know, on one level, you think that this is all orchestrated to distract us from the great elephants in our room. Mm-hmm. Economic issues, 1MDB, money allegedly sent to the Prime Minister's accounts. So, you know, when these guys turn up, you know that it's a situation which people take advantage of. And then that's when you said earlier that media comes in and we get distracted and we put this up. So, I it's a plausible theory.
Now, you started this morning with a very different story. It's FBI keeping tabs on Malaysian IP addresses at child porn
child
sites.
Pornography.
Why the story now?
Well, it's actually a story held over from the weekend, really. We have a lot of stories. And we start the day with something which we think Malaysians should know about. You know, you want to shape what people read, you know, don't shape their opinions, but you want to shape what people read, that they should know about this. They should know about a lot of things happening in Malaysia. And while we are distracted by what happened in Lau Yat, and we are concerned about the leadership in the country, there are other issues of the day that matter. You know, child pornography, sex crimes, you know, it's something which is in Malaysia we don't talk about.
You know, one of the things that Jabba told me several years ago, and if you don't, I hope you don't mind me repeating this, is that if you don't actually publish 90% of the stories that you have and the things that people tell you. Is this one of the downsides of being an editor, or is it all going to go into your autobiography when you retire, Jabba?
You know,
if you ever retire,
I'm going to keep all the secrets to my grave. I think when you know,
really, you shouldn't. You should be telling everybody. How can you keep them?
When you know a lot. I should actually tell people everything I know, but I just think, you know, I don't think anybody's ready to hear the stories I have, because it's a lot more fanciful than even the best fiction out there.
That sounds so scintillating. I please write the book quickly. I would love to read it. But, you know, going back to what Sharad mentioned just now about how media tend to get distracted by things that, new developments that happen, so you kind of forget the big elephant in the room, as you said, Jabba. How do you make sure that you stay on message so people don't forget, so we don't get distracted by Lau Yat, we don't get distracted by child pornography issues? You know, the human trafficking thing came out over the weekend. And it seems to me that over the weekend, all these things dominated the headlines and people's conversations at Buka Puasa events rather than the big story of the day.
I think the big story of the day is still there. It's simmering in the background. It's waiting for developments. You know, people want to know where did the money go for 1MDB? Where did the money come from for the Prime Minister's bank account? And where did it go? It's a slow process. The authorities are involved now. I think I've never seen the AG's chambers issuing out statements day by day as it was last week. You know, it's amazing that the civil service is getting its act together, so to speak. And people don't have faith in them. They're appealing to people to have faith in them. I like to give them the benefit of doubt, you know, just as I like to give the Prime Minister the benefit of doubt. But as long as they come out and tell what's going on, I think we'll see how it plays out, and it's that elephant in the room.
Now, Jabba, can I just quickly ask you if you could clarify the question that I've been asking on air for some days now? Who set up this task force, and was it set up specifically for the allegations made in the Wall Street Journal about money moving into the personal bank accounts of the Prime Minister?
No, it's an old task force. It was set up in 2011 when we have this law called the Anti-Money Laundering Act, AMLA. And they look into various things. But this came into their picture, into their field of view when they were looking to 1MDB. They work very quietly. They're not going to say anything. And from what I understand, it was because they were collecting evidence and some things came in late. They're working with agencies across the world. So it's a bit sensitive. It involves the Prime Minister. It's amazing, right? So...
Now, the next story, of course, is, and which is also quite interesting, is the issue of pass. Mm. But we'll come back to that after this.
That's right. We'll talk more with Java Sadiq, all the way from the Malaysian Insider on Pressing Matters. Stay with us. Good morning, 9:47, and it's exactly who we have with us this morning, a big front man of the Malaysian Insider, the CEO and editor himself, Java Sadiq, on Pressing Matters. Getting back to the task force that we're talking about.
Yeah, so I'm glad you clarified when this task force was set up, because it suddenly sprung back into the picture and I caught a few of us off guard. But, you know, this Tan Sri Task Force, as it's been called, mm-hmm. I'm curious to know who they report to. So once they find out they've conducted this investigation, who do they then report to?
Well, it's very interesting. If you look at the names at the task force, four of them sign off the statements. So three of them are investigative authorities. Mm-hmm. Two of them are police and MACC. Bank Negara is a regulator. The Attorney General is the prosecutor. So essentially, all of them, all their people are reporting to the four of them, and they have to go through all the documents and evidence and then make a case for the Attorney General to proceed with charges against whoever and whatever. So technically, all the investigators report to the four people, and ultimately, the three people, BNM, MACC, and police, will tell the AG that they have, either enough evidence or not enough evidence for a case. So I think it is the Attorney General that's ultimately the big cheese.
Right. And therefore, the rumors and or allegations of a coup, that he was trying to stage a coup, wasn't that something that was alleged against the Attorney General?
I think one blogger did it, that the six Tan Sris are involved in this coup d'etat. I think they're doing their job. And if that's seen as a coup d'etat, that tells you a lot about our country.
Right. Talking about, kind of moving on from this topic, because I know this is a story that has legs and we can talk about it till, you know, at least 10 o'clock, is the other story, and this is about context. Now, Sina Harian's front page, DAP Sila Blanca, and in it, Hadi Awang blames the DAP for the split in the relationship between PAS and the DAP. Now, in my mind, well, that's completely wrong, because it started the Muktamar, and misunderstood it? Is Hadi right? Who's to blame?
You know, it's basically like a Muslim couple at divorce court. You know, they're going to blame each other. They're not going to acknowledge that they've made mistakes, you know. In this case, I think it's very clear at the Muktamar, the ulama said, we don't want to friend you anymore. And the motion was passed without debate. And the ulamas are the highest decision-making body in PAS. Mm-hmm. Right, they said it. Nobody else said it, you know. And they said it in response to DAP saying they're not going to work with Hadi anymore, right? So it just descended into this crap that's coming out now with all the papers. Nobody wants to take the blame. I guess in any marriage or two, nobody will take the blame.
Well, it sounds as much a kind of school field kind of spat as it is a marriage spat, right?
Yeah.
The problem is now the two things. Who's left with the baby? And the baby being especially the Selangor state government. You know, DAP don't friend PAS, PAS don't friend DAP. But, okay, and PKR is in the middle. How does this ménage à trois continue?
Well, I think it's existing as it were. Azmin Ali is quite an experienced politician. I think he has learned a lot from Anwar Ibrahim. And he's managing it somewhat. We actually have a government that came in together and has sort of frayed. And I think it's great because you'd never have formal coalitions anywhere else in the world. It's always based on mutual common ground. But if there isn't, the government should collapse.
So you don't think that it's necessary for PKR to address this kind of limbo in the Selangor state government for them to continue governing? You don't think it's necessary?
I think it's necessary for the Selangor government, as it were, to explain and address its common policy and that it has the support of like-minded state assemblymen from whatever party. And if they can come together as individuals and say, look, we want to form this government and we agree on the set policies, and they have agreed on set policies, you know. There's no talk of hudud in Selangor. I think that was the main bugbear for DAP. It's the main bugbear for a lot of Malaysians, really, including many Muslims. But if the Selangor government can handle this, no reason for them to collapse.
Now, the other thing, of course, is what's happened to the G18, the group of 18 who didn't make it to the, you know, those party posts. Now, there's talk of setting up a movement that will be the core or the, that will be the undergrid for a new party. Are they completely unrealistic? Is there, and we had a history, when a splinter group moves out of PAS, that they actually survive and thrive? Can they carry the mantle of PAS, that the charisma of PAS, into a new party and vehicle?
Well, you know, in the history of PAS, Malaysian politics, no splinter party from PAS has survived. That's true. But today, you have a situation where most of the grassroots in PAS actually like working with DAP and PKR. They believe the imperative is to form a federal government and state governments where they can. The imperative is not to discuss, you know, pie-in-the-sky Islamic laws. I think they have a chance as long as the grassroots are with them. You already hear talk of a lot of branches are dissolving and they are moving on with these guys. They're just waiting for them to set up a party, and I think they will desert PAS. So PAS will be left, as it were, East Coast party with very few seats among the conservative belt.
Now, you know, one of the interesting things, because when it was led by Nik Aziz, that was a Kelantan-based party. Now it's led by somebody from Terengganu. And, you know, Hadi, of course, has that terrible history of losing Terengganu, having won it, then losing it. Do you think we're looking at a kind of shift? I mean, could it move? Could Kelantan fall to the Barisan Nasional in particular? And then, you know, will PAS be sort of centered around Terengganu? Or is that the kind of parochial politics that we're talking about?
In one sense, it's parochial politics, but I think you have to understand the Kelantan government has, since 1990, has been PAS, essentially PAS. This time, what happened last year with the floods and all has shown you that they have not done much for Kelantan. So their only salvation is to sell the fact that they are Islamist. They believe that the Hudud laws will lead to a better society. I don't think it will work. I think if you look at the elections in Kelantan, you'll see it's very close. PAS Kelantan always wins because Kelantanese from outside the state vote for them. Mm-hmm. Kelantanese inside the state don't ever vote for PAS. And that's their reality. So next election, if people see PAS as they are, they'll have to think twice before giving a vote to the Islamist party.
In it, Jabba, if we could just zoom out a little bit, right? I just want to get your sense of what you think is the health of the opposition currently. I mean, we talk every day about the bickering between DAP and PAS, and then the in-party bickering between PAS and the G18, or the new movement, as they're calling it. I mean, what is your sense of where we are in the opposition, the strength of the opposition now?
Okay, I think the reality is that in 2008, Pakatan Rakyat, which wasn't Pakatan Rakyat then, it was formed a few days after that, won because people did not like Barisan Nasional. Seriously, they felt cheated by the promises of Abdullah Badawi from 2004. So they punished Barisan Nasional in 2008. I think in 2013, it was the same. They punished Barisan Nasional. It was never a vote for Pakatan as much as it was a vote against Barisan Nasional. Now, coming to the next elections, they'll be on their track record 2 terms, and people have to ask, you know, have they fulfilled their promises? Mm. And you're seeing now they are in a disarray. I had this interview with Dato' Kadir Jassin, and I asked him the same question you're asking me, and the interview airs today. And he said, you know, Pakatan Rakyat is as weak as Barisan Nasional because they don't need to be strong. If Barisan is weak, Pakatan is also weak. They don't have to up their game. They'll just be weak together. And that's the issue in this country, because nobody sees the way out and says, this is what you have to do. Do you have common policies? What's your aim? Do you want to form the federal government? And I take his view. You know, I think today Pakatan Rakyat doesn't exist anymore. It never did exist beyond their minds, because they didn't want to formalize some of their common policies. It's an argument, because they're so strong in their branding all these years. They never want to ever be Pakatan Rakyat. So I think they'll be weaker. But next elections is actually up to the people to say, which government do I want? Do I want a government that has had so much of issues this year, or do I want a government that had fewer issues? You know, either way, you know, so it's actually up to Malaysians. I don't know.
Is there no option of a government without issues?
Yeah. Well, is it a race to the bottom, as it were? Yeah.
It is a race to the bottom. You can see, I think what's disgusting is all these politicians have failed their promises to the people. They promise leadership. They promise good governance. But they act like schoolboys in the field.
Now, I want to ask you about your choice of Khadija Jassin as somebody. He comes on the Malaysian Insider quite a bit, and you know he's always kind of like veteran journalist says something. Why is it? Do you think he has a particular insight into what's going on? Is it because he's close to Dr. Mahathir? Why Khadija Jassin?
Okay, it's very simple. One, he used to be my boss. Two, he gives you a sense of perspective, historical perspective. He started journalism in 1970. You know, he's been there. He's known all the prime ministers, right? I mean, I'm old enough to know I lived under all the prime ministers so far, but he's known them personally. He knows the insights. Yes, he's close to Dr. Mahathir. There's no doubt about it. But he gives you a kind of perspective, as particularly for Malay politics. And they are the dominant political demographics in Malaysia. So you need to know that.
Okay, looking forward, we'll probably have a short week, but what do you think are the stories that we should be looking forward to this week? Is there something, can you give us a teaser of what you might be sharing with us?
And what do you think will propel the conversation forward rather than us talking about the same thing over and over again with the facts that we already know? What do you think will propel the conversation forward and, you know, for the rest of the week?
Well, unfortunately, we cannot escape 1MDB. We can't escape the Prime Minister's bank account.
But that's a slow burn, right? Like a slow burn.
Well, you know, it's coming to Raya Week. You know, while you have your satay and your ketupat, you're going to say, okay, what happens now? Our country is greatly damaged by all this. You know, one of my friends are saying, you know, the headline today should be handphone theft sparks racial war, things like that. So people are making fun of all this. But I think this week the discussion will be, where does Malaysia go from here? Where do we go? And maybe it's a middle class thing, I think, sometimes. But more people, even in rural areas, are discussing this. We have a memory shorter than a
5-minute memory, a goldfish.
Goldfish. Yeah.
So we'll always be tempted by what's going on. But also maybe because unless we switch off all our social media, then maybe we'll discuss more important issues like, you know, fake rice or something like that.
It's been a pleasure having Jabar Sadiq over here with us, ladies and gentlemen, all the way from the CEO and also editor of the Malaysian Insider. Thanks so much, Jabar, for joining us this week on Pressing Matters. Don't forget to download the podcast if you didn't catch hold of the full interview, available at our website at www.bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.